You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Well, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We have a special guest today from all the way up in Seattle. I met Mark Canlis at the Convene Summit and was so impressed with the things that he is doing in his life and what he's doing in his business, especially with the people who work for him. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Will.
So, Mark, tell us a little bit about Canlis, because not everybody in Southern California knows about the wonderful, great restaurant that's sitting up there in Seattle.
We're a ways away. Canlis is a 68-year-old family-run restaurant. I'm the third generation, third or fourth, depending on where you start that story. And I run it with my brother, so it's a fine dining place. It's dinner only. We try to make it special.
Good, good. I think people are going to need you to speak a little bit louder for us to hear here. So
let me bring this a little closer, too.
Go ahead. All right. So 65 years.
68, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
This restaurant was started by my grandfather in 1950, and my parents ran it for 30 years, and my brother and I have been doing it for almost 15 now.
All right. So tell us what makes Canlis special.
I should let the voices of 50,000 guests tell you what makes Canlis special. I think you can look that up on the internet and see what they think. It's a good restaurant. It is likely one of the best in the country, or certainly up there with the best in the world. And I think that we've done a good job over the years of honoring tradition and also staying relevant. And that's kind of unusual for a restaurant, unusual for a restaurant of this age.
Now you recently, but you got a new chef, right? And he changed a lot of stuff that you were doing.
His name is Brady Williams. He came to us from a restaurant in Brooklyn called Roberta's. It is a well-known pizza restaurant. We are a fine dining restaurant, so to some that may seem to be at odds. We thought it was a natural fit, and he's just been killing it for us. So yes, we're super excited with him. Food Wine just named him one of the top hot new chefs on their last magazine, and I think he's doing a great job.
So. Wonderful. Now, I listened to a video of you talking to a lot of food service people. You recall that video?
Yeah.
And you said that, you know, you were risking the entire restaurant on a particular movement. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is the number one question I get asked out of that thing. A lot of people saw it, and we were talking about the future of restaurants specific to our employees and how to care for them, and why restaurants are struggling with hiring and retaining, and there seems to be a shortage of labor and cooks. And so one of the things that my brother and I aim to do, Brian is his name, is to take care of our staff and to do it in a way that matters to them now, not necessarily in the way that we think it would need to happen, but in the way that is actually serving them. It's no different than the service we provide to the guest in the sense that I'm aiming to provide you with a dinner that you think is special, not what I personally think is special. And so it's a function of putting them first. It's a function of loving and serving them and entering into real relationships with them. So we said we were going to bet the farm on that. And that was 3 or 4 years ago now. And it's miraculously not destroyed our restaurant. I think it's made it better.
So actually listening to what employees want, where they're growing, how they're becoming the best that they can be for themselves as well as good employees, right?
That's the idea. When we're interviewing somebody, the one question that really stands out to us, the one that matters, the interview process might take 12 hours or so. We'd sit you down with a couple of people, with a couple of interviews, then you stage with us, which is sort of a French restaurant term for work for free. And after 10 hours or so, we'd sit you down again. And at some point, we're going to ask the question, how will working at Canlis help you become who you're hoping to become? And we're very careful to make sure that they're answering the question, who and not what. What is a function of what you accomplish and who is a function of character. And to me, I am hoping to bring people on who are becoming better versions of themselves while they're under our employment, and that their blood, sweat, and tears is not just going to the bottom line of the company, but going into making them the kind of men or women that they aspire to become. And I think of that as good stewardship on our part as leaders. And that honestly is the cat's out of the bag. That's how you get into this restaurant, is you answer that question well, and the things that matter to you end up mattering to us. So we have, so we're looking for values there. We're looking for folks who have the same types of values as we do.
Well, one of the things that when I talk to business owners or leaders, and they are asking how to keep their people, how to retain their people, how to reward their people, I ask them to ask what is it that they want, because the reality is that I joke about it, but maybe most business owners don't recognize that people don't wake up in the morning thinking they're going to come to work to make the owner a bunch of money. That's not in their intention. And in a real sense, the business becomes the means by which somebody can achieve or can become the person they want to become.
I think if we don't recognize that, we're fooling ourselves or living in some sort of scenario in which we're out of touch with reality, or certainly out of touch with our people. And so, yes, if you look at the reciprocal, if we were to say, I'm going to hire somebody and ignore who they're hoping to become, then really I'm just using that person. And I don't know of any business owner who would stand on a platform and say, hey, please work for me, I hope to use you. It's not a very fetching line. It doesn't work in dating. It shouldn't work in employment. And yet I think a lot of the way that we've come to hire, just the scripts that we've been told, and the things that we have, just the common business practice of the day has sort of ignored this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot to be gained by paying attention to it.
Well, one of the things I work with companies and help them to learn the entrepreneurial operating system, EOS, and when we talk about hiring people or putting people into a particular position in the company, we talk about three things that they have to get it. They have to understand what the business is trying to do, the right attitude. But then they have to want to be there. Absolutely, about bouncing out of bed in the morning, that's where I want to be. And they have to be capable of it. But those three things together, so often it's simply a question of, are they capable of doing what we want them to do?
I think that's the easy thing to do, and that's what everyone's concerned about, is let me make sure that this person can do the job. And, to be fair, the hospitality industry is not a high-tech position, right? Now, it's a little bit different in the kitchen. You're going to lose your fingers if you know what you're doing with the knife. But most of the skills that we're working with can be trained or can be learned inside of a couple of years. And more important, or the things that make a restaurant succeed, is people's ability to communicate and to relate with other people. So these are not positions where you need to have a master's degree or some sort of technical skill, otherwise you're going to hurt yourself. These are the kinds of people whose job it is to look you in the eye and understand how it is you're feeling and how they can serve you and what is it that you need. And so these are people skills, the relational skills. And so that's what we're hunting. We're hunting people with the ability to communicate with others and to see other people for who they are and what they need. And that's a higher level sort of emotional skill, but that's what a restaurant succeeds on. And I would say many companies probably in non-technical positions, that's an important thing. If we start off with the question of, can you do the job, versus are you the kind of person who would succeed at this job, I think we just we shoot ourselves in the foot. I think that's the wrong question to ask.
Well, so talk to me a little about the core values that you guys have in the restaurant. You and Brian have helped to articulate.
Sure. Before we do that, can we define core values? Because the word just drives me batty. I think it's like so misunderstood, and I fall asleep every time I hear it. So,
there's got to be something that you all agree on that drives the company want it to be.
We're going to say that that values, that core values, are the things that we, the owners of the company, are hoping to become. So mm-hmm. when I ask you that question, how will working at Canlis help you become who you're hoping to become? If the person I was interviewing were to turn it around and say, well, why don't you answer that first? I would give them my values.
Okay.
I would say, well, I am hoping to be the kind of man who is trustworthy and generous and other-centered. Mm-hmm. And I could give you a long list, but those are my top three. And I'm going to spend the next so many years of my life in that pursuit and making that my principal direction. And no matter what else we do, make a little money and serve a few people dinner and engage the world, I want that to happen. And so that would be our answer. And those are the values of the company. I think the trust being the most important one. I think trust is the foundation of relationships. It's the currency of a relationship. And hospitality, by its nature, is the relationship business. It's sadly been turned a lot into transactions lately, but I don't think it's a business of transactions. I think it's a business of a relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I work with salespeople a lot, and so many of them get caught up in thinking that their job is to make a sale. Their job is to do a transaction. And what I want them to begin to understand is you're looking for long-term relationships, unless you're in the selling bubblegum. But even if it's in a 7-Eleven, you're building long-term relationships where people come back again and again, and that is not just a transaction. That transaction is the way that you build that relationship.
Right, and in order to sell to somebody, they need to think it's good for them. It's not just good for me.
Oh, absolutely, right? Absolutely. And now, what I just picked up on what one of the things you said, that so often we think about core values as who we are. But what I'm hearing from you is very refreshing. It's this is what we stand for and what we want to become.
I think a company's core values, they can be a statement of accomplishment. At least at Canlis, it's a statement of aspiration. I think we've already accomplished something. Then inherently, the next question is, well, what about tomorrow? And I'd rather just pay attention to tomorrow right now. So we're looking at saying, This is not necessarily on my resume. I wouldn't necessarily think that the whole world would describe me this way. But one day at my funeral, or one day at some weepy toast that's being given, I hope that somebody says that about me. And so it's pointing in the direction of who we're hoping to become. And I think we're all motivated in the direction of our hope. That's at least what my mother has bashed into my head for years. This was her quote, and I think it's absolutely true, is that as we look at our employees, we're fooling ourselves if we're not paying attention to that being the most important thing to them. And so why not tune into that right off the get-go?
Well, and to me, when you say this is what we are becoming, these are the things we choose to become, that becoming becomes a core value, that we are aimed at something, not simply maintaining what we already have.
The becoming is a big thing. We have this barrel of whiskey in the cellar of the restaurant, and it took us a few years to get into the United States. It's from Springbank. It's quite a special thing, and we used to sell it, and then we decided that was the wrong thing to do. So we give it away. We give it to anybody on staff or any of the guests even who have heard of this tradition. They come down to the cellar, and the idea is to pay the price. You have to share who you're hoping to become, right? So this is
unusual, nice.
But we get down there, we circle around the thing, we draw out a wee dram, if you will. My older brother was from Scotland, so we kind of hooked on the single malt thing. And you're sitting there with a really rare glass of whiskey. You've just shared who you're hoping to become, and the toast is always the same. It's here's to the courage to change. And I think that's an important toast, because I believe that it takes courage. I think it's one of the scariest things that we can do. And then if we who work together 8, 10, 12, 16 hours a day in a restaurant aren't speaking about and engaging one another at this level, we're doing ourselves such a disservice, and we're talking about relationships, but we're not actually committed to them in any way. And so we sit there around the barrel and we talk about that stuff, and then we toast, here's to the courage to change. And magically, the less important things in the restaurant tend to take care of themselves. And I think that speech that you were listening to, we were really going into some of the sort of nuances about culture and how to get your company, how to sort of inculcate your company with the right culture. It starts there. It starts with true, honest, genuine relationship. And relationships are messy and they're slow and they're not pretty all the time. And in business, we've been trained that those things need to be either hidden, ignored, or put, you know, swept under the rug. And the fact of the matter is, it's just the opposite needs to happen.
Well, I'm finding that that's as much true in business as it is in families.
Sure.
That's so often we have a form of the desire for the geographical cure, but it's much more of a spatial cure. We'll separate ourselves from each other and hope to get better.
Well, and Canlis is a family business, which allows us to integrate those a little bit better. But I think your point is well taken. No, there is no separation between church and state in this sense. There's no me personally at home and then me at business, or this is me and my family and this is me at work. It doesn't work that way. There's kind of one us. Mm-hmm. And I think the more that we can present the same self in both places, the more fulfilling it is. And so that's a goal of ours, is to get our staff and ourselves to that kind of a place.
Well, I hesitate to bring up the L word, but it sounds to me like this is very much like a business that is focused on loving people.
Sure. Yeah, we could use the word love. I think is a pretty good word. It doesn't scare too many people away. It probably doesn't get used enough. I also think it's quite misunderstood.
Yes.
So when we break that down, I might say that to be someone who is trustworthy, to be someone who is generous, and I'm not talking about generosity to me is not a financial word. It's a function of character. Generosity to me is a choice. It's not a function of your condition. And to be someone who's other-centered, yes, those are all breaking down the word love, mm-hmm, in my head, mm-hmm, and giving us maybe some more tangible things to hold on to, some tie down points so we can actually wrap our minds around, because love is a pretty, big and maybe often misunderstood concept. And it certainly tends to lose its way in the workplace.
Right. I think people get confused, and I always wonder, when did we separate relationship from making money? Why do those have to be separate?
Mm-hmm. I think historically, when we look back at the way this country at least was built, I don't think we did such a good job. And I think that we're standing on the shoulders of folks who maybe missed that opportunity in massive ways. And now we have an opportunity to step forward and say, wait a second, just because this is the way that we were doing it, that has no bearing on how we go forward and do it. And if there's anything American, I think in what we're doing at Canlis, it's that we would say that. We would say, look, we got here and we're proud of the fact that we're here, but that doesn't necessarily tell us the way that we move forward in, from this point forward. And let's reinvent that. Let's think about it anew. Let's try to find a better way. And to me, I think this country has been incredibly richly blessed, and we have the ability to actually focus on this kind of stuff. And it's incumbent on us to do so. It's incumbent on us to ask the hard question and say, hey, why is this so broken? Why relationally are we so depleted? Why do we ignore these important things? And we certainly haven't found the answers, but I'm dying to go there. And to me, that's one of the hopes of our company is, what if we ran a company in such a way that we were able to ask the really hard questions and kind of rethink some of this stuff. So I think this is, you're seeing it in a lot of places. You're seeing it just emerge all over the place. And we're by no means alone in this. but I certainly wish it were a larger conversation.
Well, and to me, so often I grew up in Texas, and in Texas, the problems were always somebody else causing them, i.e. Washington or somebody outside. And I grew up fearing all those folks outside of Texas. My father even said, when I was getting ready to go to college, he said, you got a scholarship. You can go any place that you want in the whole country. But if you go to college outside of Texas, they'll mess up your mind.
Right. No, I think that's so interesting. I love Texas. I'm not from there. But fear of the other is maybe more rampant in this country than it's ever been. And I don't think that's a Texas thing. I think that is it sort of lives inside of all of us, and it's something that we have to fight. I don't care where you're from or what your story was. At some point, we were told that we should be scared of those that are different than us, and those that that are foreign to us, and the people that we don't know or understand. And hospitality couldn't be more in disagreement with that.
Right.
In fact, the mission of Canlis is to inspire others to turn toward one another as opposed to turning away. And when we study that word hospitality, it always implied, when we go back a couple thousand years, it implied taking in, making space for, making room for a stranger.
The other.
The other. It wasn't, I'm looking at my back patio here. It wasn't a glass of rosé with your friends on the back patio. That wasn't hospitality. That was called rosé with your friends. That's right. Drinking a beer together with the boys. Hospitality was answering a knock at the door and seeing a traveler. That means they were often a foreigner. They were from a different country or a different religion or at least a different tribe. These people did not look like you. They've probably been traveling, so they're dirty and sweaty. You weren't bringing somebody in that looked and acted like you. You were making space for someone who was completely different from you. And I think that is a message for us as a country right now, just to say, wait a second. That Statue of Liberty standing out there saying, all are welcome. Come to these shores. Mm. And I think there's an opportunity for us to really grow.
Well, we in Southern California are engaged. Some people at different levels of engagement. We are engaged in an enormous experiment. We have several hundred languages in our public schools. Mm. We have. We're at the center of immigration from the South, immigration from the from the West. We have people from all over the world. Yep. I was once waiting for my wife to come back, and I was in the Bradley airport at LAX. That's the international terminal. It is amazing how many people just in one day come through that terminal.
Yeah, from all sides. And I've been to California, so you can't blame them. It's nice down there.
Yes. Well, but it is this enormous experiment in how to live together, and what I really love the way that you put it, is this enormous experiment in how to create a space for the other.
And honestly, you can't practice, study, or at all pay attention to hospitality and not understand that that's where that word comes from. And remarkably, I was more speaking of where it's sort of rooted, which would be down closer to Rome. But when we go up in the northern European areas, it didn't just imply making space for a stranger. But in some of the Celtic traditions, you made space for them and then you defended them. That's to say, if the next guy knocking on your door is looking for the first one, it's over my dead body.
Right.
I just think there's a beauty to that that we have lost. And there's a fierceness and a courage and something so cool that just, it doesn't exist anymore. What happens now is we turn away from. When something is different than, when something is other than, when we're uncomfortable with what we don't know, we turn away from. That's a protective measure. That's a to go inside. That is a folding of the arms and turning one's back. And it's innately vulnerable to turn towards. When little kids are ashamed they don't make eye contact anymore. And when they are feeling loved and loving, that they just lighten you up with eye contact. And when they've done something wrong, they turn away. Right. So this is something that we see all the time, which is a turning away from. And man, I think there's such an opportunity as business leaders to practice turning towards. And it ain't easy. And I'm not very good at it. I've got 105 employees listening right now, probably like, what's that guy talking about? So it's something that I'm working on. But again, it's aspirational. It's this crucible of running a fine dining restaurant. I hope it isn't about serving people dinner. To me, it's about maybe becoming someone who is like that more. And maybe that's something my kids see one day, or maybe that's something that the employees see or that the guest feels. But there's more to business than accomplishing making of money and the things our company set out to do.
So, well, let's think a little bit about that. When we think about why we are here, I mean, if we're living in a world where we actually believe that somehow we popped into this world and that we will decay and be gone, sure, then maybe it is make a lot of money, have a lot of toys, and celebrate. On the other hand, if, as I believe, I mean, we've been around for 13.7 billion years some way or another, and we're going to be around for at least another 13.7 billion years in the future. And in this particular place, we have the opportunity to serve, to be hospitable, to create that place for the other who is really us, right? I mean, we're not that separate.
Yeah, you know, I think I've found in my own life that focusing on myself is a hollow pursuit. And I'd be lying to you and everyone listening if I hadn't said I spent a lot of time doing that. So I'm speaking out of experience here. But there is something innately hollow, innately, not worth it when self-gain is the end goal. And there is something alive or something just joy giving that when you're in service to someone else. And so that right there, I think you just have to ask yourself, what am I doing today? Is this for me or is this for something bigger than me? And yeah, geez, I hope that I am on the latter end of that conversation, you know, and otherwise we all just pack up and make good for ourselves and go our own separate ways. We've seen what happens when that happens, and it's not good.
Well, you know, when you talk about service, I've been in many restaurants, I've been in many places of hospitality where they are there to serve me. Now, when I look at what you do and the kind of things that you've talked about, it seems to me that you are inspiring people to think about, to articulate, and to look for the things that they hadn't even thought about doing. I mean, you talk about not making your restaurant the center, but making the guest the center, and right, and helping that guest to have a unique experience of their own life in the midst of your hospitality. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been to restaurants where you feel like you're on their roller coaster. And you walk in and sit you down at a table, and it's like you're strapping on that shoulder harness, and away you go. And you better like the ride because there's no getting off. And I think Canlis has always aspired to put the guest in the driver's seat in that way. And I think service, true service, is that. It's not a function of what we think is special. It's a function of what you think is special. That's to say, I don't believe that the owner or the chef or any of us belong in the spotlight. It's you, the guest, that belongs in the spotlight. And it's the restaurant's great honor and great privilege and great challenge to keep you there and to bend what we're doing We have this statement in the restaurant called "Keep the Promise," and we finish every meeting with it, and everyone yells "Chef!" And "Keep the Promise" to me is this idea that some people have waited their whole lives to eat in this place. I mean, every week, every day, almost, I meet somebody who says, "You know, I've been living in Seattle. I've been driving past your restaurant. I've wanted to come here my entire life." And these are people who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. That person has quite a built-up expectation of what dinner is going to look like, and I want a restaurant that's willing to change what we do to meet their expectation. That to me is service, and that's what keeping the promise means. And shoot, other than that, Brian and I just deciding with Chef what we think is cool. Yeah, three of us might think it's cool, but if you don't, this is your one night, right? This is your daughter's only 16th birthday. It's not going to happen again. That's one night. This is the night that you and your wife celebrate your first anniversary. Or all the time I get, you know, couples in, and she looks like she's ready to explode. And she's like, "Well, I'm having a baby in 3 days, you know?" And it's like, this is our last night out before the baby comes. And Lord willing, they'll be parents the rest of their lives. This is like one last date before, like, those are serious things. The reason you go to a restaurant is because you trust it. You don't go to a restaurant, believe it or not, for the food. On a place like ours, the food's got to be good. And that's a rule of the game. You don't go for the view. And ours has, you can see the entire city and mountains and lakes. Sure. The view is important. The ambiance of a restaurant is important. That's a rule to the game, but it's not a good strategy for winning. And as a strategy, I think paying attention to what the guest brings you, what's going on in their world. Man, maybe they just found out they had cancer. And in fact, we serve guests with cancer all the time. So, hey, here's the last time we're going to have Christmas Eve dinner with grandma. That's a big deal. And if you don't recognize that as a staff, you've got it upside down. You've got service backwards and inside out. You've got to see what they're doing, what they're bringing, where they're at, and take what you have, which is a brilliant menu and a beautiful view and amazing wine list, and serve them with it. Does that make sense? And too often, I think the guests are in service of the restaurant. They're kind of on a program, and there's no getting off that program until the bill comes. I just, I don't know.
How often do businesses believe that their job is to sell their products or services? That's what we do.
Offer it.
All right. Versus our job is to find people who have a problem that they want to solve, that we can help them with. And that means stretching, because maybe we can help them and maybe we refer them to somebody else. But our job is to seek out those people who have a problem they want to solve.
Sure.
And that sounds to me very much like find people who have a celebration, finding people who have an event in their life that they want to celebrate.
Yeah, and what problem can the restaurant solve for them? I'll tell you, every one of them comes in with the same need, and it's that tonight needs to matter.
It's not for food.
Not for food. They're hungry. Yep. Yeah. They come hungry. That makes it easier to serve their need. But they all arrive with this need that say, "Hey, tonight needs to matter. I need you to make me look good on this blind date. I need you to make me look good in front of my boss. Or I need you to help me serve my wife because it's our anniversary, and we've been having a hard week all week, and we've been fighting in the car." You know, like you see that, and you say to yourself, "Great, what role can I play? How do I meet you and where you're at?" And that's what makes our business fun.
When we come to Canlis from Southern California, that's not going to be, "Oh, we're happen to be here for business, or we're doing this. Maybe we'll go over there." That will be a journey, and that will be a destination at that point. And that to me is the celebration.
Well, make no mistake, it's not just that you could pay attention to that, right? Because if the food wasn't any good, and everyone walks out with food poisoning, we're not serving anybody. No. So there's a foundation here that all those things have to be lined up. You got to kick a lot of ass. You got to be a great company. But that doesn't make you great. That's just sort of like the foundation.
That's what we call in poker. That's the stakes. Well, I mean, that's what you put on the table to even begin to start, right?
Right.
That's the ante. That's the ante.
Yeah. Right. Everybody put in first. And I think as business owners, it's tempting to focus on those things. It's hard. In fact, it's hard to get past it. Look, we work hard to make that restaurant feel special. Work hard. There are only 4 hours a day. We only serve dinner, but there are 4 hours a day we're not using our kitchen. So it's a ton of work to cook dinner. Dinner's got to be awesome in that sense. But it ain't about dinner. Dinner exists to serve the guest in some of their capacity. Dinner exists to honor them and to celebrate them, to cherish them. And, you know, mom, she, back 20, 30 years ago, she found this big Kuradora. It's K-U-R-A, and a Japanese treasure house. A Kuradora was the innermost of three sort of locked doors, right? And these villages, the people would often keep their most prized possessions, like their most sacred possessions, and sort of a common treasure house in the village. And then there were these three doors, and the Kuradora was the last thing standing between the outside world, whether that's a robber or a fire or a flood, and your most cherished thing. She heard this story, and she said, that's exactly what we're doing. I'm going to stick that thing in the front. So there, you walk in the front door, you're going to be staring right at a Kuradora, right? Mm-hmm. And the symbolism there was, don't you ever forget that what they're bringing us is their most cherished possession, and your job is to safeguard it.
Yeah.
Protect it. It is right. And so in that sense, I think that's why you can run a company in a hard industry, which the restaurant is, and have trustworthiness be your number one thing, because that's what people are coming to you for. They're coming because they trust you. Like, hey man, tonight needs to matter, and I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna go to Canlis. I know they're gonna take care of me, right? It isn't because they know that we're cooking, I don't know, gooey duck with some goofy, you know, kumquat mignonette. Nobody actually woke up saying, I want to eat gooey ducks and kumquats. That's just not what you do. You wake up saying, man, tonight's that date night. I want to make it special. I hope it's awesome, right? So the kumquats and the gooey duck need to be good. I'm not just making this up.
right.
Not on the menu, by the way.
Right.
But like that has to be awesome. That should be the best thing you've ever eaten, but that's not why you're coming.
That's right. People are not going to come to Canlis because you happen to be number one on the New York Times list of best restaurants. That's not what it's about. They're going to come to Canlis because somebody said to them, wow, yeah, that was a mind-blowing experience.
I agree with you, but if you know anyone at the New York Times, do you think you could get me on that list? That'd be awesome. I don't know if it could be an aside thing here. But,
Well, my goodness, you're on the Pilgrim on the 405. What more can you want?
It's just, you know what? I misspoke. But the New York Times would be number two for me.
There you go.
There's definitely, it's fun to go treasure hunting and go to all the world's best restaurants, and I love doing it. And that is a thing also. It's a special thing. But I think by and large, you got to ask yourself as a company, are we here to serve ourselves or are we here to serve someone else?
Correct.
And I would love to be leading a company that could answer that right by saying.
Well, Mark, people are going to be listening to this. Tell them about how to come to Canlis. Tell them where you are. Tell them how to get a reservation, and then you can tell them how to help their business become more like that.
It's easier to get there than to get a reservation.
All right.
Let's see. So we're about an hour and a half. We're about a mile and a half north of downtown Seattle on a hill called Queen Anne. Seattle is a town of hills. We overlook Lake Union and the Cascade Mountains. We're essentially in downtown Seattle, but we're in a little neighborhood just on the north side of the city. The easiest way to get there is to drive or take an Uber. The easiest way to get a reservation is to plan way in advance. So it books up, I don't know, a couple months in advance sometimes, and that can be kind of a pill, and we apologize in advance. But yeah, it's a special spot. And I say this to my staff all the time, even though the restaurant is full and we've been so blessed to run a full restaurant, there's not a day that doesn't go by at 5:30 when we open and somebody walks through that door that I don't feel thankful. Cause it's a business and that could go away. That could turn around tomorrow. And, I never want to run a place where we're sitting back resting on our laurels. The challenge of a restaurant is that yesterday doesn't matter. It's about tonight. And we're going to have our hands full tonight, and we're going to go right into battle and meet that challenge as best we can, and hopefully take care of guests in a way that they've maybe never experienced before.
Wonderful. But, that's wonderful. Mark, I really thank you for taking time to be with us today. And there's a tradition of in the Jewish community saying next year in Jerusalem, but we'll change that to next year in Seattle.
Fair enough. I look forward to it.
Well, all right. Thanks so much for being with us, Mark.
Same. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And there you are, folks, the Pilgrim on the 405, telling you how to thrive in your business in California.
You've been listening to the Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.